What's up, everybody? Welcome to SWAT MMA, where we're smoking weed and we're talking mixed martial arts. This is episode number 121. I'm Jared, here with Paul.
What up?
We're coming to you from the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. Today, we're going to be smoking and talking all about the UFC 270 and its main event between Ciryl Gane and Francis Ngannou for the UFC's heavyweight championship. We're also going to be joined later in the episode by UFC flyweight and women's MMA pioneer Roxanne Modafari. But before we get into all that, you know what time it is. Grab your weed, fire it up, and let's get into the weed of the week.
Smoke weed every day.
How's this bowl hitting, Paul?
Pretty nicely.
It's good. We got some brand new weed this week, man. This is called Party Foul. I'm going to take a hit here. What do you think?
Pretty nice. The smell on it is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, what do you think of that? Nice. Like, what does that remind you of?
Honestly, there's not really many other strains it does remind me of.
Well, it is a cross of GMO cookies, which is garlic, mushroom, and onion, and that's crossed with birthday cake. So, okay, yeah, that's sense. Why.
That makes sense. Yeah, those are actually two of my favorite strains, too, so I mean, that's perfect.
Yeah, you could actually taste it on this, too. I can taste the GMO. It has a very unique flavor. And on the inhale, and I can taste the birthday cake on the exhale. A lot of weed I can't do that with.
Yeah.
But this strain is pretty impressive. This is made by Canardo Genetics. And garlic, mushroom, and onions, for those unaware, is a cross of Girl Scout cookies and Chem Dog, which is where it gets that funk from. That Chem Dog funk mixed in there. And then birthday cake is a cross of Girl Scout cookies and cherry pie. And cherry pie, breaking that down a little bit, is Granddaddy Perps and F1 Derb. So it's got that sativa all the way back to Durban Poison.
Yeah.
This is a 50-50 split indica sativa, but it gets those sativa roots from Durban Poison.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Which, incidentally, if you're listening, folks, and you ever come across Durban Poison in your local dispensary or wherever you might obtain your smoking stuff from, peep that out. It's one of the last pure sativa landrace strains on the planet.
And it's fire as fuck.
Hell yeah. Let's load a fresh bowl of this. You got some ground up in there?
Yeah.
I don't have a little, I'm just going to have to sacrifice a pen here.
Sacrifice. I forgot my tool.
Whatever you're smoking on out there, folks, we hope it is delicious. Hey, you know, did you hear that we're about to get smoking lounges here, finally?
Oh, yeah? There's only that one in New. Other than that, though, they passed that law, like, right before COVID happened, so it would make a lot of sense that now that people are allowed to actually, you know, go out, that they're starting to open them up.
Well, it still requires a vote from city council. It's not 100% approved yet. Now, Nuwu Dispensary can do what they do because they're on Indian land.
Yeah.
And so that's like that their drive through and some other things. Like, I think they're open 24 hours.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, a lot of dispensaries say that, but they can't technically sell weed, to my understanding, during certain hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they can sell their other products. I could be wrong. It used to be that way. It could have changed. But anyways, that's how Nuwu gets away with some of the things that they do.
Yeah.
But the remaining part of, like, Paradise, actually Las Vegas proper, still got to go up for vote, but they're working on it. They're trying to get it finalized, where they're mainly looking to avoid complaints from people who don't smoke as far as odor goes. So their idea for that now is that it has to be attached to a dispensary, which is kind of bogus if you think about it. Like, dispensaries are expensive as fuck, dude.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, let's be honest. It's
yeah, but so is any kind of club is going to be like that, too. It's like the same thing between a fucking... I could see the thinking behind it, you know? Same thing as, like, buying a drink at a bar is going to be expensive. Buying weed at a club is going to
be expensive. True. Like, if you live here, you know the difference between, say, going down on the strip and grabbing a fucking drink for $30... And maybe going down the Fremont Street and hitting fucking, you know, Fremont Casino and getting a fucking dollar Corona at happy hour.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And maybe this the same thing. It's just being a local here for so long. I just can't. These prices at dispensaries are just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine sitting in a fucking place where you're paying $18 a gram plus tax to smoke bowls. I just fucking loaded a gram in this bowl, dog.
Yeah.
Like, that shit adds
up. Well, that's one good thing about the Nuwu tasting room is, like, they have, like, package deals where you kind of buy it, like, there's tiers to, like, when you reserve a spot, there's, like, tiers to what you could get. And then there's, like, separate also where, like, you can do, like, from what I saw, they said on there that you could do a dab for $10. Pretty solid. I mean, it's not too bad when you're talking about like a price driven up. Like $10 for a dab is not that bad.
I mean, I guess especially if you're a rookie smoker. I mean,
oh yeah, you get if you're like a fucking just like a regular
like a regular Joe Blow.
Joe Blow fucking social smoker, dude. You'll get fucked up for $10.
Dude, the first dab I ever did, and even being like a steady smoker at that time, I went in to get these tattoos on both my forearms, and it was just me and the fucking dude in the shop. He's like, bro, you smoke? I was like, of course I smoke. He's like, do you really smoke? I'm like, yeah, dude, I smoke every fucking day. And then he had a fucking a dab rig in the back and some fucking, called a honey oil back then. Fucking holy shit, I was high for like 6 fucking hours. Blaze, dude. I took like 6-7 just monster fucking hits off that thing. Me as a smoker my first time.
I can't even remember my first dab.
Fucking, I can't imagine, like, if you're just, like, some dude who's maybe smoked weed once or
twice. Oh, yeah. And then you get introduced to a dab, and you're like, oh, yeah, $10. It gets paid. Yeah,
it was a good deal then.
You ain't going home.
All right. Well, let's spark this bowl up here, Paul, and let's dive into, because we're going to take a deep dive today, into the UFC 270 main event. And we're going to start off actually as we're smoking and talking here with laying out a little bit of history, because we've got what the UFC is billing and what is technically true as a UFC unification bout between two champions, Ciryl Gane, the interim champion, and Francis Ngannou, the regular champion. But there's a whole lot more to what like they're talking about on UFC Countdown, correct?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of our listeners only know maybe the side the UFC is presenting.
Yeah.
And these days, they're leaving a lot out. Like, the MMA casuals, I mean, the MMA hardcores, they know Francis's story.
Yeah.
They kind of know what's happening here. But we're gonna dive deep and start off by kind of laying the history of these two fighters and what their stories are and why there's so much intrigue with this matchup and what might happen not only in the fight, after the fight. It involves a lot of things. So
yeah.
With that said here, I'm gonna take a puff on this.
Well, and I do think a big part of this story as well is what the UFC has played into it. Because just to start this whole thing off, just my kind of theory on this whole thing is, sure, there's some like bad blood, just as there would be with any other guy getting into a cage and fighting each other in their underwear. But, like, fucking, there's, like, the UFC has created a narrative that I don't necessarily think that Ciryl Gane exactly believes. He's just, like, riding the train because he's the guy who they're telling that they're going to do all this shit for, and they obviously have as far as his career. But I don't necessarily think he's 100% on the train, so to speak. You know what I mean?
I can see your point with that. And honestly, I hope so. Because, you know, part of the downside of this whole narrative that's coming out that we're going to, you know, explain here in detail in a minute is that it's souring me a little bit on Ciryl Gane as a fighter. And I don't really think
that's his nothing fault. To do with his own personal life. It's nothing to do with his personality. It has nothing to do with how he carries himself or anything like that. It's more of how the UFC is used him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
well, I think naturally, because he's the champion and because both of us feel like he's gotten wronged in all this, why don't we start with how Francis came up and how he became, where they all tie in.
Yeah, and I do, you know, upfront agree that I do believe Francis has been snubbed and wronged here by the UFC and kind of by his old coach as well. But I'm just going to lay out Francis's history, and this is straight off Wikipedia here. It's just the easiest way to tell the story here. Ngannou was born and raised in the village of Bataï, Cameroon. I might be mispronouncing that. If so, I apologize. But he lived in poverty. He had very little formal education growing up. His parents divorced when he was just 6 years old, and then he was sent to go live with his aunt. At 10 years old, this dude starts working, bro, in a sand quarry outside of that little village that he was born in because of no money for his aunt and for him. Like, that's pretty crazy, 10 years old. I mean, you can't even legally do that in America if you wanted to.
Yeah.
So 10 years old, this fucker's out there working. As a youngster, he says he was approached by several gangs in the village to join them, but he refuses, and he decides to use his father's negative reputation as a street fighter for motivation to do something positive, and he wanted to have boxing be that positive thing that he did. So at the age of 22, Ngannou starts training boxing, and kind of despite the fact that his family really didn't support him with that shit at all. After training for a year, Ngannou stops training due to illness, and then he has to start doing various odd jobs to make ends meet, and he's kind of in limbo until about age 26. He decides to go to Paris, France, because he can get better training there, and pursue professional boxing. Mm-hmm. So as a quick aside, you know, Francis talks a lot about boxing now, and people are like haters are like, oh, you just want the payday, because they're talking about him and Tyson Fury. Like, well, of course he wants a payday, time. But yeah, actually, that's been his dream since he was a youngster.
Yeah.
So... he moves to France, but however, since he gets to Europe, this dude, he winds up getting put in jail for 2 months in Spain for illegally crossing the border. So that sucks. After he finally reaches Paris, because he's been in jail, he's got no money, he doesn't know anybody, he's got no friends, and he's got nowhere to live. That's the dedication that this dude has. So he's working in the fucking quarry when he's 10, right? Yeah. And he does what he can to learn boxing there, and I'm assuming... And I think this is a safe assumption that he stays there till that age because he has to help out his family and earn whatever money he can to give to them, right?
One quick aside to that same story is when he was trying to get to Spain, he got caught 7 times and on the 8th time got there. So he was like caught and imprisoned 7 different times for various amounts of time, like a day or two, and then they'd send him back, or like a week they'd send him back. And that like was over that period in which he moved, he got to Spain. Before he even got there, he was pretty much jailed every single time he tried to get over there to try to, you know, better his life. And he was seen as like a captain of the boat, he said, when they got over, because everyone around him was doing it like their first or second time, or, you know, like, you know, people would not get it one time, they'd give up. He refused to ever give up. Got stopped 7 times, and on the 8th time, gets over.
Isn't that incredible?
No.
Man, so he finally reaches there, and, you know, like I said, he's got no money, no friends, no place to live. And so he's homeless on the streets of Paris, literally. And he gets introduced to, by a friend, to Ferdinand Lopez and the MMA Factory. And so Francis is a big fan of Mike Tyson, and he really wanted to learn how to box, but Lopez really felt that the potential he saw in Francis would be for mixed martial arts. Yeah. And so he convinces Francis to try MMA instead. Lopez gives Ngannou some MMA gear, and he lets him train and sleep in the gym at no cost. Okay? And thus, this sparks Francis's MMA career. And he had his first fight in 2013. Right? And then he's gone on from there now to be the UFC champion. He's got 19 total fights. He's 16. And three, okay, his 3 losses have come by decision. He's had a couple stinkers, which we'll dive into these guys' records along the way. I'm gonna give Francis his own words on some of this, because I think this is important here. And then we'll wrap up Francis's history here and talk about Cyril here in a second with this. It says, reflecting on his journey across continents, like you said, and his decision to become an MMA fighter, Ngannou said, quote, When I started, I had nothing. Nothing. I needed everything. But when you start to earn money, you start collecting things. I want this, I want that, I want that. The purpose is not collecting things, though. The purpose is to do something great. Finish the dream that you started. As a quick aside, the dream that you started with him, again, was boxing. Yeah. I think this is going to play a lot into this discussion. Mm-hmm. Back to this quote, I want to help my family first, of course, but then I want to give opportunity to children in my country like me who have a dream to become a doctor or something. If I reach my dream, it will give me the opportunity to help those in my country who have their own dreams and nothing else to fulfill them. I want to give some opportunity for children like me who dream of this sport and don't have the opportunities like me. The last time I was in Cameroon, I brought lots of materials for boxing and MMA to open a gym. Now I just bought a big space to start the gym as well. A lot of children now in Cameroon, because of me, they have a dream. They say, I will be a champion in MMA. I will do boxing like Francis. Because they saw me when I was young. I didn't have anything. I didn't have any opportunity. And today they see me and they are dreaming. They are thinking that something is possible. Even when they are so poor, something is possible in life. It is not easy. It's so hard. But it's possible. And I think that sums up a lot about Francis Ngannou.
Yeah.
And
his mentality and what do you like, what his overall goal is. And that's why I think it's really suspect of people to constantly be like, oh, he's just money hungry. He wants it. Yeah, but he's not going buying a fucking Lambo and fucking fucking Ferrari yacht and all that bullshit. He's going and he's trying to do something for people that, you know, he watched for years, you know, get wronged and, you know, not have a chance. And that's unfortunate that, like, even in this day and age that's happening, you know what I mean? And for people to hate on him for trying to get paid more, get these bigger fights and all that kind of stuff, it just doesn't make much sense to me.
No, I agree. And the level of poverty that people are experiencing in a place like Cameroon is something like, you know, sitting here, you and I in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Couldn't even fathom.
I mean, we can't fathom it because even the poverty that we see here, and we see stark, but there's stark poverty in the city, and it's weird because there's so much money here.
Yeah.
And there'll be like a homeless person in a tent right across the street from a $2 billion casino.
Yeah,
it's really wild. Yeah. But even in America, when you're poor and even in the worst of situations, you're so much better off than you are in a place like fucking Cameroon.
Yeah.
Like, it's something that we just, there's no way to grasp it unless you're there and you see it. Mm-hmm. And so the importance that that is to someone like Ngannou, we can't really understand. We can only try to understand it.
Yeah.
And that's why, and we'll get into this more after you talk about Cyril for a second. I get so upset when I see the UFC, like, on that embedded, when they're talking about, well, he just went to Africa on vacation. Mm-hmm. Like, motherfucker, he's not on vacation. Yeah. What, do you think he's sipping Mai Tais and going surfing? Did you hear what he just said? I mean, that quote I just read, I don't need to repeat it. That's why he's going back there.
He's trying to, you know, he's trying to get something going, you know.
Yeah. We'll touch on that. Why don't you share a little bit of Cyril's, you know, backstory? Because they have some history together, but Cyril's history is quite a bit different. It's not going to be as... Francis Ngannou has this amazing story.
Yeah. Cyril has a bad story. You know, he's from originally from France, came up as an athlete. Like, he used to play soccer and basketball, and you know, you could tell he's naturally a gifted, like, you know, physically. And then but instead of pursuing his athletic dreams, he ends up becoming a furniture salesman in France and in Paris, actually. And a friend of his kind of introduced him to Muay Thai and the MMA Factory, and he just kind of fell in love with the sport. Ends up starting as a Muay Thai fighter. Ends up going 13-0 with 9 knockouts. Picks up a couple of belts as well. And then in and this all was in 2014. So this is kind of where the timeline kind of matches up. You know, Francis started in 2013. Cyril starts in 2014. They're both kind of coming up in that same MMA Factory up in France, and I think this is kind of where, like, things match up when you talk about these two guys, because one thing we do need to talk about that has come up recently is there's been training footage from back then that has come up in his trainer has released to the media.
Yeah, because Francis is no longer with MMA Factory. He lives here in Las Vegas, actually. He's, you know, he's adopted Vegas as his new home city. And if you listen to Francis's side of the story, it was no secret that he wanted to come to America. Yeah. Going to France was a first step in a long journey that wound up with him being in the United States.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense, because this is where you would want to come. To have the best opportunities for fighting, especially if your heroes are like Mike Tyson. Anyway, I mean, this is the spot. That's why he's here.
Yeah.
So he says that he told his trainer long ago that this is the ultimate move, and his trainer, and even offered his trainer to come with him. He says, I can't leave my gym and my team here, but I'll help you get there. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so Francis comes here, and he has some difficulty finding a team. You know, he's with Extreme Couture right now, but he wasn't right away, and he has some difficulty. Like, he leaves the gym, and he loses a couple fights. Mm-hmm. He's got that fucking stinker with Derek Lewis.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But now, in the build up to this, since Cyril has burst onto the scene, we've had this drama that now circles this fight, Paul. Which,
yeah, because if you really look at it. I'm just going to kind of try to play it as close to, like, the trainer's mentality as I can.
Yeah, the trainer's the dude, his old coach, Lopez.
Yeah, he's the one. Yeah, he's the one who's kind of doctored this rivalry. But at the end of the day, I do think it's kind of a case of he thought Francis was going to be the golden goose, and Francis kind of, that wasn't what he wanted in the end, so he ends up leaving and going to the States and training out here and stuff like that. So yeah, now he kind of has his other guy who now is his golden goose, where is Cyril gone? And he's like, you know what? You weren't that special anyways. We're going to show you how special you aren't, because we've got a guy who's about the same size as you, who we feel is more well-rounded and blah, 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 or however they feel about Cyril gone. And he's going to come in and show you why you should have stayed with us. And I kind of feel like that's the whole foundation of this quote-unquote rivalry, because I don't really necessarily think it's a rivalry. I think it's a gym beef that has really nothing in the same way as when Cowboy fought Mike Perry. Remember Mike Perry was talking all that shit for Cowboy for leaving the gym supposedly, and training at his ranch.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he didn't even stay there for more than two fights. You know what I mean? It's kind of,
I think it's a
gym beef more than it's a rivalry.
I agree, and even to the extreme, it seems to me it's more that the coach, frankly, Lopez, is butthurt because he went out on a limb with Francis, gives him a place to stay when he's homeless, and so he feels indebted, and you can argue rightfully not. I would see that. And then Francis fights for the title and loses, and then ultimately leaves the gym in search of greener pastures, which... And by greener pastures, I mean, that's what I think a lot of fighters make mistakes. Like, take Conor McGregor, and we won't dive into that, but I think he makes a mistake staying with Kavanaugh only.
Yeah.
Like, it takes guts to expand out and learn more. I mean, let's be honest here. France is not some powerhouse MMA country, bro. They just got it fucking legalized.
Just legalized, there. I think, 4 years ago, 3 years ago.
Like, he can find better trainers, not... No disrespect to Lopez, but anywhere else on the planet, I think, than in fucking France, okay?
Yeah.
And they just don't have any history of this already young sport.
Yeah.
But he just seems like, because he said it's more than just Francis left. He said personal things, like, Francis is a shitty person. Francis owes me money. Francis fucking said he'd be here and he didn't. And he just seems like he's very offended that Francis left, and now he wants to talk shit about it. But I don't know if it's just to build the rivalry and hopes to sell the pay-per-view and Gon wins.
Yeah, but you got to remember, he's getting a slice of that if that pay-per-view is huge for Gon. You know what I mean?
Because when you hear Francis talk, I've only heard him say that he's disappointed to hear his coach say this, that he didn't think he was that type of person, and he's not as good a person as he seems, kind of like the same thing Francis said about him. But then that he wishes everybody would move on and just... the best for everybody out there. Like, what do you want from me?
Yeah. Well, and I do think winning this fight is his opportunity to move on.
Well, let's talk about their actual training together.
Yeah.
Because I was under the impression initially that it was for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And then some footage comes out which makes Gom look good and Francis look bad, and it's released by the aforementioned coach, Lopez, here.
Yeah.
And Francis says it's not doctored, but it's just an edit that makes him look bad, and there's plenty of shit that makes Gom look worse. Mm-hmm. And
I don't really think that matters, though.
Francis comes out with an interview with the UFC on ESPN and says that they only train together for like a month, maybe 6 weeks, maybe a total of 8 times, which is really nothing. Mm-hmm. So we have to take that as some kind of face value. I don't know why Francis... I can see why Francis would want to downplay it, and I can see why the other team would want to play it up.
Yeah.
So let's say it's somewhere in the middle, a couple months, they train together. Mm-hmm. Does that matter?
I don't necessarily think so, because...
It's 4 years ago, Mike.
Well, not only that, yeah, both of them have changed and evolved so much probably since then. But not only that, it's just I don't really necessarily think training footage could be used as a ledger for how good one fighter is and one fighter isn't. You wake up on the wrong side of the bed and decide, today I'm not going to be able to go 100%, and you get your ass whooped, and those kind of days happen in the gym. So I don't necessarily think that video footage holds that much water, like when you're talking about 4 years later and both guys are completely different fighters. You know right. what I mean? Like, even if you watch that footage, like, even on Cyril Gane's side, like, he doesn't look as sharp as he does now. You know what I mean? Like, neither of them really looked very sharp. It looked like two guys who were, you know, just not very hardly sparring. You know what I mean? And that's all it was. You can't really be like, oh, look at that. Gane whooped him 4 years ago in training. Like, he's going to win the fight now. No.
Especially when both of these fighters are so raw in their MMA. I mean,
even now they don't have that.
What did you say? Gon had his first Muay Thai bout in 2014.
Yeah.
And
then his first UFC or MMA fight in 2018. So that's.
And we know Ngannou had his first MMA bout in 2013.
Yeah.
So. These guys are very, very raw fighters. Mm-hmm. Their shit 4 years ago is meaningless. There's no way that's the same fighter. You can't make a case that that's the same fighter. It's not like they've had this long pattern of stagnant, you know, ability or something. This body of work that's remained the same for all this time. Absolutely not. So,
well, and I think if you look at Francis, I think he's evolved more in his game in the last 2 years than the like six before that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, his game was so focused on what his specialty was, which was like power and, you know, like knocking people out, that when he got to Stipe fight, he got so exposed that he had to make that change and get out of that gym, or at least bring other coaches in with some other eyes, of course. And that's what he did for a while too. He did. I think it was the fight after the Stipe fight. He did half in France and half in Las Vegas.
And yeah, he invited the coach with that. It didn't work out too well from
recollection. It was the Derek Lewis fight. Now, is what it turned into.
Which is an absolutely terrible fight.
Terrible fight.
For both of them, not just on Francis's part. And Derek Lewis was an equally horrid participant in that fight.
Yeah, it was rough. But yeah, so I just feel like you can't judge that fight based on that footage just because neither guy is at their peak. I think now both guys right now are at their peak. Like,
same. So I think we're both in agreement that this former training partner's narrative is meaningless when it comes to the actual fight itself, and then who may or may not have an advantage. It makes for a fun story.
The only thing I could see it having any kind of like actual like consequence on the fight is possible like small tendencies, like, you know what I mean, like a guy you watch every day, like there's always going to be some small tendencies that they're going to carry their entire career, and you know, maybe something like that, but I don't see it as being like, oh yeah, Francis couldn't beat him round to round in training 4 years ago, so he won't beat him now, You know what I mean?
Okay, so here's a question then, Paul. What is the coach's goal in releasing this, no matter what, edited somewhat? It wasn't the entire sparring session. So this clip that shows Gon getting the advantage over Ngannou in a sparring session 4 years ago, he releases this to the media on purpose. It wasn't like, you know, some hacker found it and put it out. These motherfuckers put it out knowing it's going to run, and then they start talking shit like, yep, see, look. What is he trying to do here? Rattle Ngannou, build a story, be a little bit dick. Still, he's butthurt, and he's trying to make Ngannou fucking be embarrassed. Like,
I think a little bit of both. You know, I think it's you want to drive the narrative that you're going to win the fight, but I think you also want to like twist the knife in Francis's back as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I mean, you're going to war with him anyways. War of words to begin. Possibly could make the war in the octagon a different game. You know, we've seen over the years tons and tons of different fighters get melted on the microphone and step into that cage and put out terrible performances, and maybe that's their ploy to you know, get into Francis's head, I guess.
I don't think it's going to be successful. I was a little concerned prior to this that maybe Francis was rattled, but after seeing his interview with Megan, he seems pretty focused to me.
Yeah.
So we're both in agreement that this training together is really not, it's not a consequential. So let's talk about this other aspect to the fight. How do we wind up with an interim belt here? Ciryl Gane is not just the number one contender fighting for the title. Somehow they make a title fight between him and Derek Lewis. And if you watch the UFC's countdown, which a lot of our listeners, I'm sure they have, they're going to hear this story that is true, but it's not exactly factual. But it certainly makes it seem like the UFC was ready for Francis to come back. And he was like, nah, I'm going to be on vacation. And they were like, no, it's been forever. And he was like, nah, I'm on vacation. And they said, well, we can't wait any longer. We have to make an interim title. And the division has to move on. And that's actually not really what happened at all.
He was champ for like, what was it, like 65 days or something like that after they had already offered him the belt to be defended?
Yeah, I thought it was 90 days, but it was somewhere in the 60 to 90 day. And they started trying to get him to come in for a camp or for a fight date. And he, at the time, said, I can't fight. I believe they wanted it to be September. He said, I can't fight on, let's just pick an arbitrary date. I think it was the 25th, but I can fight 2 weeks later. Okay. Right. I'm sure my dates and months are slightly off here, but that's not the point. Yeah. It was literally 2 weeks afterwards he says he's good to go. The UFC's like, no, because the UFC at the time was in a spot where they had lost a main event. I believe it was due to the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed a title shot to headline a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And they wanted Francis. He says, I can't do this date. I can do 2 weeks later. He's been the champ for 3 fucking months. And they say, we're going to make an interim title.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Which, mind you, we'd had a year between defenses prior to that with this whole DC Stipe thing. This belt has the lowest frequency, off the top of my head, of any titles defended in the UFC.
Yeah.
Cain Velasquez was even less than once a year. These guys tend to make Khabib look busy as the champ, okay? Like, it's just the nature of the belt. A lot of the times, it's a once-a-year defense.
Yeah.
Cain was champ for, like, 6 years and fought, like, 3 times.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, so it's not unusual for it to be a 12 months.
Yeah.
We all wish it would be more, and there's times when there's contenders when we want it to move along. But saying that you can't fight 3 months after you won the title, or even 4 months or 5 months or 6 months,
it's nothing new.
We're going to fucking create an interim thing and say you're not the champ was ridiculous.
Yeah, with like zero injury or any kind of thing like that.
He's healthy. Francis is fine. He says, I need 2 weeks. Because you know what he's doing? He's in Cameroon.
Yeah.
Which I beg to challenge the UFC's fucking language here. They're doing it purposefully to make him look bad. I guess you can technically say the man's on vacation.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's a fun spot? You think they have a lot of luxury condos for him to go stay at in Cameroon, where he used to work as a 10-year-old?
Yeah.
In the fucking gravel pit or whatever the hell it was? Mm. Like, this is ridiculous.
It's pretty
nuts. He's over there trying to help his people in a country that really could use some help.
Yeah.
And he is not holding up the division or the belt or the title. They're talking about the UFC was in a bind, and their solution was we can make an interim belt and we can fuck this guy over. Because at the same time, Paul, what was Francis doing on social media and in interviews? What was he talking about?
Honestly,
he was talking about fighter pay.
Well, not only that, there's a whole another fold into this too, because we got to remember is the UFC dangled that Jon Jones fight right like in front of his eyes.
The fighter pay issue leads into that, because they talked about the Jon Jones fight immediately after Stipe. If Stipe won, he was going to fight Jones.
Yeah.
Francis wins. That's all the talk.
Yeah.
Francis is like, well, I want my money to fight Jones. And Jones is like, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
That's a super fight. Mm-hmm. People get paid more for a super fight.
Yeah.
And so he made several statements in public about this.
Yeah.
Over the course of this 3 months on the social media. And who doesn't like that shit?
Dana White.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like it. And honestly, their relationship has been rocky for a while.
Comes out and shits all over his manager.
Yep.
But there's so much even behind the scenes on that, because his manager works for, what is it, CMA, which is the other major talent agency in Hollywood, whose main rival is Endeavor, the company that owns the UFC.
So
they're going to shit all over their main rival, especially if they can do it through another channel that makes it look like, you know, Dana White knows managers. He says, this guy's an idiot. He must really be a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. Like he's fucking some guy like Ali, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know he works for a real talent agency as a registered fucking agent.
Yeah.
So there's so much to this thing in which I don't understand it. I mean, I get it. Dana and the UFC is taking a hard line on fighter pay, and they're never going to fucking budge or look like they're fucking pushed around by a fighter. They're just not going to give, and they make small exceptions for one single person. And who's that? Fucking Conor McGregor.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, that's it. No one else is going to go box, dude. Conor can fucking say, I'm not going to do certain things, and he gets away with it. But even him at the end, they weren't putting up with his shit lately either.
Yeah, it's true.
So I think this title, the interim title, is a joke.
I think the interim title was done for one thing and one thing only. And I think it's to tap into the market of France. You know what I mean?
Is the market of France somehow bigger than the market of Africa? Africa's a fucking continent. That's France is like the equivalent of a state.
Yeah, true. True. But I'm just saying that this is what the UFC is like doing, because this is what they always do. If you want to look just on the same card, look down at the co-main event between Brandon Moreno and Davison Figueroa. Is literally every 2 seconds the UFC is talking about how Brandon Moreno is from Mexico, because now they've started this boxing versus MMA, because for so long in Mexico it's been kids come up and they box. So now he's trying to tap into that market in the same way. Now in France, now that MMA is legalized, now they're talking about headlining cards out there. And if you're the UFC and you've got an opportunity where you have a Frenchman who is at the top of your division, you put a belt on him in that same way that Francis was talking about. When he became champion, it made every kid out there, you know, want to be champion as well. And you know what I'm saying? That's just the only point of view I could see the UFC doing this, the whole interim title, obviously, and they lost all their main events and shit like that. But I'm just saying, for Ciryl Gane himself, like, he had, like, what? He was 4-0 in the UFC, and then they just gave him Junior Dos Santos. Like, that's,
and then they gave him Derek Lewis for a title.
That's not normal. Title shot. You don't just get JDS and then, like, in your fourth fight in the UFC, like, I don't care what point of his career he's at. Like, that just doesn't happen.
I think it was the fighter pay issue. I mean, yes, the interim belt was definitely created for the just for that pay-per-view, well, yeah. And they took advantage of the situation that was available at the time to take advantage of. But the rift goes deeper because they were fully on board the Francis Ngannou train. So, like, he up till this, till he won the belt, there's no denying the UFC was on his fucking. They gave him the very first ESPN card. He got multiple title shots. He headlined fight after fight after fight. Dana would come out and talk about what a nightmare this guy is. He's the hardest puncher we've ever seen. And now he's out here at the PFI, or, you know, Performance Institute, and he's fucking fixing everything. It was all about that, and it was all about he was Nigerian, and he's this, and he's that. And then he wins the title, and the John Jones shit goes down. And because it was Jones and the move to heavyweight, there was a lot of publicity about it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Ngannou was very vocal about fighter pay and refusing to fucking do that fight. I think that fight would have got made.
It goes deeper than that, though, because that goes all the way back to the Derek Lewis fight. Because since that Derek Lewis fight, I've literally heard Francis Ngannou say this 4 times on Ariel Helwani's show. Since that Derek Lewis fight, he's talked to Dana White less than 5 times.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, that's where the rift, I feel like, starts, is all the way back then. Because I feel like you're right. They did all, do all that, and they did talk about Francis and all that stuff. But you know when they were doing that? They were doing that after the Alistair Overeem fight.
But I mean, after that, I mean, I hate to disagree, but after that, like, he loses to Derek Lewis, but then he headlines UFC Fight Night 2, Blades and Ngannou, in China.
In China, yeah.
You know what I mean? And then he headlines the very first UFC on ESPN against Kane. Now, maybe they were hoping he would lose against Kane, but he fucking smoked him.
Yeah.
And you know, but I think you're right. I think that's undeniable,
though.
Like, I think you're right, though.
Him being the main event of a like, fight night card doesn't necessarily justify it for me. Because, like, at the end of the day, his talent and where he's at in the division is undeniable. He's at a point in his career where you can't really stick him very deep on any card, even if you wanted to.
Well, now they're trying to downplay it, the UFC is. His fucking, now I hear a lot of talk about how he's, you know, he can't really stop a wrestler. Really? What was Stipe?
Exactly.
What was Curtis? I mean, look at his, since his stinker of a fight against Derek Lewis, okay, he has gone on to beat Curtis Blaydes by TKO, Cain Velasquez by KO, Junior Dos Santos by TKO, Rozenstruik by KO, Stipe to win the title by KO.
And he stopped the takedown on Stipe and took Stipe down.
Bro. And Kane, Curtis, and Stipe are all credentialed wrestlers.
Oh, yeah.
Junior has pretty decent MMA wrestling.
Well, he just fucking KO'd.
Even though he just boxes him. But he just smoked all these fuckers. Yeah. You know what? Now Ciryl Gane suddenly some miracle fucking wrestler?
I don't even think it's that at all. I think... Here's my keys to victory.
Let's wrap up this snob here. So I mean, I guess that wraps it up here. It started with the Derek Lewis shit from our perspective, and morphs into the fighter pay, and then this thing with that fight was kind of like the last straw, but it also helped them fix a problem they had.
Yeah.
And then once the die is cast, the die is kind of cast, and Ngannou was like, "Fuck you," Dana came out and shit all over his manager, and now here we are.
Exactly.
And Ngannou is unhappy right now because there's still more to this before we get to the fight because he is on technically the last fight of his contract for this fight.
It's true.
But because he's champion, there's a clause. It's called the champion's clause, which if he wins, his contract is automatically extended by one fight in 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And the UFC has first bidding rights. And you can't talk to any other promotion for that 6 months.
If he loses, then the UFC can match any contract if they choose to for 90 days.
Yep.
And if they don't want to do that, then he's a complete free agent. I think it's 6 months. It could be. But either way, Francis has come out publicly now within the last week or so and said he will not fight for $500,000 or $600,000 again.
Mm-hmm.
And he will have a boxing clause in his next UFC contract, period. So we'll discuss the effects of what happens after we talk about the fight itself, because that depends a lot on if he wins or loses here. Yeah. But that's the scenario now. is that his relationship with the UFC really couldn't be any worse.
Yeah.
He's come out and refusing to fight for the money he's going to get for this fight, which is probably a $500,000 base pay,
mm-hmm.
okay, with more than likely a $500,000 win bonus as well.
Yeah.
And probably some pay-per-view points. But we talk about pay-per-view points a lot still because we're used to champions getting that, but we forget it's a whole different era now in the ESPN shit. And we don't really know what these guys get for pay-per-view points because the UFC gets a guaranteed $500,000 equivalent of in money from ESPN.
No matter what.
No matter what. And then they get some fraction of the money. If ESPN gets above it, and ESPN gets most of it. Mm-hmm. There's not like all these dollars left over for fucking fighters, and I promise you they're not guaranteeing any of these fighters even a dollar at a half a million fucking sales.
No.
So we don't really know what that's like anymore.
Yeah.
It's got to be something, we would think.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's something, but can't be the same.
It's like, not the payday, because that's why Brock Lesnar didn't come back.
Yeah.
That's the thing no one wanted to talk about is, they're like, oh, we couldn't reach an agreement. Yeah, because them pay-per-view buckets aren't there no more, son. Yeah,
exactly.
Brock ain't no fool.
No.
So, anyways. Now let's talk about the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Ciryl Gane gets a lot of hype. Talk about that a little bit, Paul. Like, they say he's a complete fighter.
I tend to agree. I mean, he's
undefeated, right? What's his record over there? 10-0?
Yeah.
Who's he fought? What's his, like, his UFC? Who are the four guys in the UFC he's fought?
Well, he's actually fought seven times in the UFC.
Give him the mic.
He's fought seven times in the UFC, but I think I would say his like best wins that are really comparable to Francis's would have to start with the Junior Dos Santos fight, where he TKO's JDS and ends his career in the UFC. And then you go up to the Rosenstruck fight, which was kind of a little rough one, but I think it was also a situation where Rosenstruck just had nothing for him and he could just make him work harder.
What was the final decision on that fight? What were the results on the Rosenstruck?
It was 50-45 all the way around.
Oh, it was a decision with him and Gane? Yeah. And,
oh, you're talking about Rosenstruck and Gane. It was fucking knockout.
No, seconds. I meant Gane and Rosenstruck. Yeah. I wasn't sure what his... it was a decision.
Yeah, it was a decision. And then picks up another 5-round decision of Volkov, but he fucking whooped Volkov's ass the whole time. And then TKO's Derek Lewis for the interim title.
Yeah.
So, I think where...
That's not a bad resume.
No. I just think the difference between a fighter like Ciryl Gane and a fighter like Francis Ngannou is Gane has a lot of weapons that he's not afraid to use, and he uses them the same way I'd say like a middleweight uses their jab. Like, you know, Francis is the kind of fighter where he's going to put your fucking lights out with every punch. And I think Gane is more the type of guy who's going to try to break you down over 5 rounds and try to just like, you know, find the holes. And he's not thrown with 100% power really very often. He's just popping you. You know, he's just kind of, he fights weird. Like, it's weird. He's like a middleweight trapped in a fucking heavyweight's body.
I keep hearing this, and even though they look nothing alike and their fighting styles aren't very similar, and it's hard to remember when he was this, but it kind of reminds me of what they used to say about Travis Brown before he went and got ruined by Edmund Tarverdian.
Yeah, that's what I...
There was a lot of, you know, he's the dominant Cruz of heavyweight. Mm-hmm. Type thing.
That's how I feel about Ciryl Gane, though. He's very strategic with his striking, but he never really is thrown at 100% power ever. I don't think we've seen him hit somebody as hard as he can yet. Like, honestly, it's very strange. He just pops people, gets in the clinch, you know, uses his dirty boxing. You know, he's pretty good with his leg kicks as well. And I think obviously that probably comes from his Muay Thai background. But I feel like in a situation where he was going to beat Francis, he would have to stay so far on the outside and just try to pick his shots here and there and try to tire Francis out over 5 rounds. It's literally the only... I think those are his keys to victory for sure. Like, he has to stay on the outside, pick his shots, stay away from Francis' big shots, and tire him out over 5 rounds and kind of, you know...
Do you think he attempts to take Francis down at any point?
No. That's just not his game.
I agree.
This is not his game. He's going to, if he's going to beat Francis, it's going to be on the feet.
There's a lot of fans, like, the power of Dana White. Dana White is a charismatic individual. I have a love-hate relationship with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But the power of Dana White and the UFC is they control a lot of the narrative and a lot of the fans kind of go along with it. So when Dana and the UFC sour on a fighter, there's a reverb that the fan base gets, okay? So when you go and you read a lot of articles and you look in the comments and you go on Twitter and you look at a lot of the sentiment, there's a lot of talk about how Francis suddenly, all he is just a wild man puncher. He doesn't really have that much skill. Whereas Gon is super technical, and they make it sound like, you know, Gon is so much superior in technique to the almost barbarian methods of Ngannou that he's going to get smoked. And I think that this is ridiculous. Yes, there are times in Ngannou's fights where he has thrown wild punches, but he has also shown evolution as a fighter. I mean, the problem with his evolution and his increasing skill set is that he's knocking people out so quick we don't get to see a lot.
That's true.
Okay, look at these last fights. Okay, he KO'd Stipe. That was a long fight for him. Is it 52 seconds of round two? Yeah. But in the first round, what did he do? He did stop some takedowns.
And he took Stipe down.
And he took Stipe down. Stipe is an underrated wrestler and athlete. Okay, yeah. He was a former baseball player. The dude's really good. He's really strong. He's a firefighter, as you know. The dude's strong.
Mm-hmm.
He got taken down. That's improvement as hell right there. But then the problem before that, not problem, but he fights Rosenstruck, right? It's a 20-second fight.
Yeah.
He fights Junior Dos Santos. It's a one-minute fight.
Yep.
He fights Kane. It's a 26-second fight. He fights Curtis Blades. It's a 45-second fight. He hasn't had a chance since Derek Lewis to show any of his skill set.
That's true.
And so I think he's being, frankly, vastly underrated as to what he can actually do in the cage.
Mm-hmm.
And if the fight goes long, you said that Cyril's best chance to win is kind of to stretch it out and tire him. And I agree. The problem with that is you got a dude whose resume proves without a doubt he can land a fucking knockout punch at any point. It's like the Deontay Wilder thing. He's only got to land one solid hit on you, son.
Yeah, but...
And that's dangerous to try and stretch it five rounds.
Just play a little devil's advocate here. But I do think at the two worst points of his career and the two... I'm sure, obviously, he's evolved, but I'm saying the two losses he had this career, we saw him get tired out over five rounds. And that's really what happened. When you watch the Stipe fight, Stipe stayed away from his punches as long as he could. Started utilizing his wrestling and using other ways to, you know.
Stipe has an extremely high fight IQ, and he did what was needed to
exactly
to stop.
tire him out, and then took advantage of him late. And I think even in the Derek Lewis fight, I mean, Derek Lewis didn't do much, but I think the anxiety of it and both them, like he looked tired after the second round. I don't know if that was the adrenaline dump and all that obviously plays into that fight more than the Stipe fight, but he was even tired at the end of that fight.
Yeah,
so
for those of you listening that might be wondering about this atrocious fight we keep referring to sum it up real quickly, they both stood and stared at each other
for five rounds
and maybe threw a punch or two and didn't engage. It was awful. A
lot of feints.
And you say, well, why would that upset Dana so much?
It was a main event.
It was a main event. It was supposed to be a really big deal. And Dana hates that shit.
Everybody was talking about it. It was like, oh, this fight.
Yeah, it was an embarrassment for the company. Like, the fight was so bad, it was embarrassing. It wasn't bad because their skill levels weren't there. It was bad due to a complete lack of effort from both fighters. So moving on from that, though. Let's talk, before we talk about the after effects of each guy, if they win, why don't you say who you think is going to win and how?
I think Francis is going to knock him out in the second round.
Okay. I agree. I think this is going to be a knockout for Francis.
But I could see a world where Cyril wins his fight as well, though.
I think it's going to be a little later, though. I think it's going to be a third round, and I think it's going to be a clean sleep in him. Not a TKO, but he's put asleep.
Yeah.
Because I think that Cyril's going to be able to escape and move
the first talented. Couple
rounds.
That's why I hate this whole narrative that the UFC's created. He's a talented fighter,
yeah.
And I feel like I don't know. I feel like they've created this narrative that either people love, he's polarizing at this point. Like, people love him or hate him, when I think they don't necessarily, there's any reason to hate him, you know?
It's his coach. Like, I don't like the look his coach is doing. It annoys the shit out of me. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think there's any reason to release training footage, man. I don't care who it is. It's fucking training footage. I didn't like it when Conor did the Paulie Malignaggi training footage. I mean, I get it because it helped sell this narrative. Mm-hmm. But, it's the gym. I've been there. You've trained in wrestling. I've trained in boxing. Dude, shit that's in the gym is in the gym, dude.
Yeah, shit happens.
It's not the fucking... You can't judge somebody's skill level on that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a fucking fight.
Well, what do you think happens in the case that Cyril Gane were to pull this off?
Well, I think the UFC is ecstatic. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that's their dream come true, and I
think they run it back.
Look, the UFC tries hard not to take too much interest in politics as a whole, despite Dana's, you know, personal leanings and support towards whatever.
Yeah.
But they don't like bring it into the cage very often. But they put a lot of emphasis behind having certain nationalities and skin colors of champions, and they try to play it off kind of like they're on the whole, I don't want to say equality, but like breaking boundaries tip. But the truth of the matter is, they're on the whole, how big is this fan base that we can sell to
them? That's exactly it.
Okay,
that's exactly true. So, they're doing that with Brandon Moreno. They do it with a lot of people.
Yeah, there's people that might hear that and think that sounds like really, like maybe I'm exaggerating or being an asshole, but I don't mean it to sound negative. It's just the fucking truth. Okay, they play up on this shit in order to sell fucking fights.
Oh yeah, they take advantage of people constantly. Yeah.
And go count how many times they tell you that Brandon Moreno is the first Mexican champion in that fucking countdown. Like, it was ridiculous.
It's
dude.
Cool. That's great. It's I'm awesome. Proud of him. For him, though, the way that they're using it to like monetize his fame is
where
they
did it to Kane, who was born in California. They wouldn't shut up about how Kane was the first Mexican champion, even though he was
never was.
Actually, he's from Cali, bro.
Yeah,
he went to fucking U.S. He went to college in Arizona, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Like, he tried out for the Olympics on the U.S. team.
Yeah.
But that's just how hungry they are to sell fucking this shit. And I think with Cyril, they see a guy who's the same skin color, who has that going for them, as Ngannou, who then may not offer the whole continent of Africa, but they've got Usman has got that kind of covered for him. And Izzy. Okay, even though Izzy's, you know, they've both left, but they still got those roots.
Yeah.
And now they can open up Europe more with this dude and the black market. Okay, that's what I think is their eyes. So they're hoping Ngannou loses, because they lose this headache, this money, this problem child.
Which he's not.
Which he's none of those fucking things. Okay? But in Dana's and the company's eyes, which is profits first, UFC brand over fighter always.
Yeah.
And fighter dissent is squished publicly as quick as possible. And think what Dana can say behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You think you can dictate your pay? The heavyweight champion of the world got bumped out of here. I made a new belt. We got a new guy. And that fucker's gone. You're going to toe the line, too. Because that's what will have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Francis will have spoke up. They went and made a new belt, made a new champ, and Francis fucking lost, and he's out the fucking door.
Yeah.
So y'all shut the fuck up and do what we say, and take the fights we say when you're going to take them, because even a belt won't save you. That's my guess as the behind-the-lines talk.
Okay. I see that. I can see that.
I think that sucks.
Sucks, but that's kind of where they're at with it.
So I think they really want him to win. I don't think he's made any noise about fighter pay. I'm assuming he's happy that this has happened to him in 4 fucking UFC fights.
Yeah.
And that's not his fault whatsoever. None of this is shade on Cyril Gane. think he's a great fighter. I think he's going to get KO'd in round three, though. Which opens up a now what for the UFC. I don't think they're going to be happy at all. I think there's a snowball's chance in hell of them letting Ngannou box Tyson fucking Fury.
No.
I don't think they're going to pay him what he wants to fight Jon Jones.
No.
And would be hard-pressed that they're going to cave into him and give him some crazy contract.
Yeah. Not happening.
I mean, they might give him a bump.
Yeah, I think he ends up getting a bump, and they're going to give him a big enough bump to shut him up if he wins. That's really
They seem to do that a lot of the time, but yeah. Do you think he's the guy that that can happen to? How important is the boxing? This circles us full around to Ngannou's story, okay? He has publicly said within the last of this recording 3 days he will not fight for $500,000 or $600,000, and he will box. And this is not Connor going, I want to box Floyd because I see dollar signs in this opportunity. This is a man who, since he was a child, has said, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. It's going to be tough.
Yeah.
I honestly don't even know at this point.
I can't see the UFC caving.
Yeah, me either. I could see them caving maybe on a boxing match, but I don't know about the pay thing. I feel like they'll hit him with incentives over the money, and he'll possibly end up get shut up that way. I'm telling you, they're just master negotiators over there, and they make you feel like, you know, you're taken care of. But in the end, if you compare him up to a lot of the people, that unless you're like the 1% of the UFC, you're really not getting paid that much.
And even them,
even the 1%, yeah, some of them.
Francis Ngannou would definitely qualify as the 1%. I mean,
yeah.
The heavyweight champ is supposed to be the guy.
True. That is true.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And not even in just the UFC. It's supposed to be the guy, the baddest man on the planet. The only person that has any slight claim to that would be the heavyweight boxing champion of the world.
Yeah.
But we all know in a street fight who's winning that, so. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a self-defeating argument when they start talking. Who's really the baddest dude on the planet? So I think, do you think that there's a possibility that Francis Ngannou wants to box so bad and he's so sick of the UFC that he kind of... I'm not trying to besmirchify his good name. He's a good Dips. Guy. But do you think there's a possibility he kind of gives a half effort and I don't want to say throws the fight, but... Goes nah, out and puts up a stinker and loses so he can just...
Yeah, I don't know. That could happen, but that would be damning to his legacy. That would fuck up his boxing, like his boxing future.
I think if he loses a decision to Ciryl Gane...
It would have to be really, so close.
I don't think it fucks up his boxing. He has already lost a couple fights. It didn't fuck with him at all. It doesn't erase anything he's done. Because this boxing idea, let's talk about this a second. It's not as far-fetched as people might think. The WBC, who has Tyson's belt, they've already said, sure, that fight makes a lot of sense, actually. Okay?
Yeah.
Fury is kind of in limbo. He's got a mandatory against, you know, this in negotiations right now with Dillian White.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Anthony, Joshua, and Usyk are tied up. Okay? And Fury would certainly take that boxing match.
Okay. I think so.
So it's not that crazy. And you've also got Jake Paul very quietly with his MVP promotions who hasn't said anything public. This is pure speculation on my part. But you tell me that, let's just say, however it happens, Francis loses and he doesn't get slept and made to look a fool.
Yeah.
And he's still got his good name. That Jake Paul doesn't try to get in on some of this fucking Francis free agent Ngannou action. And sign some crazy fight, or even Triller with their seemingly endless pocketbook and this triad combat bullshit.
Yeah.
You got Fury. You got a lot there where he could make life-changing money that another UFC contract ain't going to give him.
Could be. That would just suck.
I want Francis to win, but also, dude, Paul, I kind of want Francis to lose.
I want Francis to win in life.
Yeah, I want him to be free of this UFC contract and pursue other opportunities, because I think you have this crazy story that the UFC is just not on board with anymore. And we have this weird thing happening where Jake Paul's making $40 million fighting fucking guys who ain't even in his fucking sport.
Yeah.
You can't do that, but you can do a couple of these fights, and maybe he can help you, as much as I hate to say it. Or maybe the heavyweight champ and the WBC is willing to accommodate you. Maybe Bellator is willing to do some shit where you actually get sponsors.
Yeah, that's true.
Because Francis is a guy who's going to get more. Dude, and he's a guy whose sponsorship money is going to be more than your average fucking fighter that goes to Bellator from the UFC, bro.
Yeah, true.
He can get life-changing sponsorship money, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen to the guy. If folks listen, and go listen to his interview before this with Megan. He sounds... His story is amazing. You heard me tell parts of it.
Yeah.
He's super nice. Like, he's like a really soft-spoken individual. He's got a great big kind heart. And his shit could be a movie. He was working at 10.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He goes to France and is homeless. Mm-hmm. Now he's at the PI. He's sleeping everybody. He's fought all these former champions, from Orlovsky to Overeem to Miocic to fucking Kane and Dos Santos. Laid waste to them all eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing story. So I am just, to wrap it up, convinced that the UFC is praying for Ciryl Gane to win this fight.
And I don't think he will. Well, let's get to our interview with Roxanne Modafari.
Let's do it.
Joining us today is a true pioneer in women's mixed martial arts, who is currently the 12th ranked flyweight in the UFC, Roxanne Modafari. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It's absolutely our pleasure. Hope your holiday season was good. I read on your blog you got a little bit sick. Are you feeling back to good these days, it seems?
Yep, back to normal.
Okay, good. That's really good to hear. So, you know, we've got your big retirement fight coming up at UFC 271 on February 12th. But before we talk about that, I'd really like to rewind things back to the beginning of your career, fighting in Japan, 2003. I believe it would put you about 21 years old, junior in college, fighting for Smack Girl. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
It was really exciting. I had no idea what it meant to be a pro fighter. Like, I loved jiu-jitsu. I did some, you know, kickboxing and karate, and I was like really into anime. I still am into anime, but I was like, oh man, is this gonna change me into some kind of beast? Like, what's gonna happen to me? Like, I didn't know, right? And it was really cool. Actually, I feel like fighting is kind of like entering a different dimension. Like, my brain like works differently in the cage than it does outside, which is kind of cool. I guess that's the zone. But yeah, so I went to Japan, and you know, I joined a gym there, and the jiu-jitsu sensei was like, oh yeah, sure, we can get you a fight. I was like, oh really? Now? Like, do I need, I don't, you know, need more? And he's like, no, go ahead. So they got me a fight with Smack Girl, and I don't know, like, I trained the kickboxing, I trained the jiu-jitsu, and then I fought. Like, back then there weren't really MMA classes, which is totally different than now. Like, man, I've seen such an evolution of the sport. You know, like, before I just, you know, did my jiu-jitsu class and kickboxing and then fought, but it was cool.
What's the culture like there as far as women fighters? Because, you know, here, especially then, it was virtually unheard of. Even now, still some people seem to not be accepting it for whatever reasons. What was Japan like at that time?
Back in the day, female fighters were a different category, you know, like they referred to our clothes as costumes rather than fight clothes. Which confused me, because they're speaking Japanese. They're like, "Kostumu wa doko desu ka?" What is kostumu? Like, I don't understand. And you know, it was, I do believe that female fighters were lower level than men at the time, you know, but it was like even more so, and there were like specific fans kind of just for them. It was more like entertainment than sports, you know, so I went through that, and I was more into the sports than the entertainment aspect of it. But after like a decade, you know, fighters like Megumi Fuji started getting fights in Shuto and more like high level male organizations, and then it started like females started being accepted as actual athletes, you know? So that's where we are now. I believe there's still like amateurs are still kind of like, there's more the entertainment aspect of it, but now like females are recognized as athletes, I think.
As for sure, which is, it's so great to see this evolution of the sport. You know, I've got a young daughter and I've always pointed out fighters to her ever since she was little, not because I wanted her to be a fighter, but just because I wanted her to see that women can do anything, even get in a cage and fight people. And you were always a bit of inspiration to her as well, because you don't look like a lot of people would expect a fighter to look like, and you like a lot of things she does too as well. So hi. I've had my eye on your career for a long time, and I'm surprised to hear that, you know, you just started training in Japan and then almost instantly into a fight, because you saw a lot of success over there. In, I mean, you fought Jennifer Howe twice. You have two victories over her. And at the time, as far as I can tell, she was considered at least a top fighter in America, one of the best in the world.
Well, I trained for a while in America before I went to Japan. Like, yes, I had a bunch of stuff under my belt before I actually fought. I just expected more training before I actually got my debut. So it was kind of like a surprise. But thankfully, my jiu-jitsu was good enough that I was able to jiu-jitsu everybody and, like, win that way.
Yeah, I should clarify. I think you've been doing taekwondo since, what, 13?
Yeah.
And amongst many other, and judo as well. Uh-huh. And then, of course, the kickboxing. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, I went back and forth. Basically, after I finished college, I was flown back and forth. You know, sometimes I fought in Japan, sometimes I fought in the States.
We've noticed that had to be a little stressful, I would think, because, like, you won the Fatal Femmes Fighting Championship at lightweight in LA, and then you flew right back to Japan, it would seem, and then you fought in the one grand tournament, where you fought three times in one night, and you won that.
Grace, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, the K Grace. Yeah, the K Grace is the open weight tournament, correct?
Yeah.
How is that wear and tear going back and forth like that?
You mean by weight class or just by...
No, I mean just the amount of traveling that you're doing. I mean, you come to America, you fight here in the States, and then you fly to Japan a few months, you're fighting in Japan, and then you're back in America.
Oh, I don't remember how much time passed, but I was young, man. I was durable. I could do anything. Like, bring it on. Like, I always felt like finding a fight was the hardest thing for me. I was like, I'm here in Japan. Like, please give me a fight. And it was hard to find somebody my size in Japan. They managed to sometimes, but then, like, it was hard for the promotions in America to fly me because I was expensive because I was in another country. So I always asked Kirik, my first MMA coach ever, to, like, join me, like, because he lived in Massachusetts. So, like, the promoter would fly me from Japan and then pay for his ticket, which was cheaper because it was America. So I was always, like, trying to find a fight anywhere.
Yeah, so when you were finding, like, so many different, like, major organizations, you eventually end up being in, like, a pretty groundbreaking season of Tough, being like the inaugural season for women's fighting, like ever really, after Dana White had said all the things about how he'd never have women's fighting in the UFC and everything. How was that like experience for you, not only in the house, but like being a part of that?
Man, it was so cool. Like, it's hard to see it as it's happening, you know, because you don't know how it's going to turn out. But now in hindsight, like, I've been a part of so many groundbreaking things. Like, I fought in Hook and Shoot, which was like the first all-female card in America, then female Fatal Femme Fighting, and then Tough and The Ultimate Fighter season 18, you know, which first had females. It was like, oh, it's so cool. Like, I found out about it on Twitter, excuse me, and like had to immediately ask for time off and like book a ticket like that day to make it in time. It was just so cool to be a part of that. And then to be able to be on season 26 of The Ultimate Fighter, which introduced the flyweight division. I was like, oh, this is wonderful. This is so cool. Like, I've had such a cool career, man. This is awesome.
Were there any, like, big differences between the two seasons as far as, like, I don't know, just, like, the dynamics in the houses and everything like that?
Day and night. It's day and night completely.
Well, that first season was Rousey and Tate, correct?
Yeah.
Was there a lot of tension on the set there? Because, I mean, you know, the media plays it up, like, of course. But when you're there in it, could you feel tension in the air? Or was that more played up for the cameras?
No, we could feel the tension in the air for sure. Yeah. And then there was a little more drama amongst the contestants as well. So, yeah.
And how did that compare with you on Team Gaethje in the second time on Tough? And Eddie Alvarez was the opposing coach, correct?
Yeah, and at that point, like, time had passed as well in just the fight world and, like, what am I trying to say? Elevated training methods as well. And people were being referred to as athletes as opposed to just fighters. You know, yeah. I was like, I'm an athlete? Like, what? Like, it was like, I wasn't used to hearing that, you know, I was just a fighter, but now I'm an athlete. So all the women were like super dedicated. They wanted that title belt, right? So like, I woke up like at 5 a.m. every morning and I went for a jog and there was Barb Honchak, there was Lauren, there was like, people were up and like doing yoga. Nico was doing yoga. Like everyone was like focused. Nico and I went to bed at like 9 p.m. every night. Like it was locked less in. Drama, more focused, you know, and yeah, it was different.
So how do you feel like that like set you up? Because really, if you look at the end of that season, that really set you in kind of like, if you look at your career overall, like you progressed so much after that season and into like your run into the UFC, like after all that time, like how do you feel like that really set you up for your run in, that you've had in the UFC?
Yeah, that was such a great opportunity for me to be able to be on Tufts 26 and then be into the UFC again. You know, I had not made the cut for a tough 18, and frankly, my skills weren't up to par. I just moved back from Japan, and I was, like, feeling broken, and, like, my body just was feeling broken, and then I got with John Wood from Syndicate. He's an amazing trainer. He did so much for me, and I really, like, stopped plateauing as I felt, and then my skills went up. Also, Lorenzo Pavlica, my personal trainer, physical trainer, like he healed my back, he healed my neck, like my shoulders, like I had so much stuff, but just through strengthening, like he helped me. So like I had a good run in Invicta where I was able to like get myself back going again.
And oh yeah.
Tough happened and I was like feeling strong and healthy and like I can do this. So that was like, okay, go. And so it was like my opportunity to get in there and I was able to show what I had worked on.
Your striking and your overall game has really, really improved since you've been out here in Vegas, as you said, under Wood at Syndicate. And it's a little bit unusual, you know, for fighters to have kind of a later career resurgence. I think it's hard for fighters to have the discipline to learn a new thing or to improve on an area. We see a lot of people plateau. Yeah. And so I was really impressed by what you've done since you've been out here. And, you know, now we're coming around. It's, you know, 2021 ends. We're at 2022 and you've announced that your upcoming fight at UFC 271 against Casey O'Neill is going to be your retirement fight. What was some of the thinking that led you to that?
I never really wanted to think about a fight being my last fight, to be honest with you. It was about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, where I started noticing that, like, in practice, getting hit in the head would hurt more than it used to. Like, I used to be able to just eat everything and just train hard, but now I'm like, oh, can you go lighter? Like, oh, can you go lighter? Like, crap, like, that shot rocked me. Like, it used to not do that. So I was like, man, like, I should probably start thinking about my brain health and, like, calling, like, figuring out when I need to safely stop, because I promised myself that. Like, my dad always, like, sends me articles like, look at this boxer, he has whatever CTE, like, you know, he can't talk to her straight now. Like, all right, I'm like, okay, dad, like, I promise, like, once I start, you know, before I start having brain problems, I'll quit, like, I promise. So I promised both myself and him that, you know, I'm still good now. Like, I've started wearing headgear, and that's great. Like, I feel good. It's hard to grapple with headgear on.
Yeah.
But I was like, all right, let's make it 50 fights. You know, that's a great number. I'm breaking a world record, I think, because a lot of places don't count my Ultimate Fighter fights as fights because they're like exhibition or whatever. So that's 47 or something fights. I lost track, but that's like a world record, you know, I'll be breaking. So
we all know it's 50. That's nonsense. So Dana can have it on TV. I do believe that, you know, they can't have the results leaking or whatever, but those fights should count. It's 50.
Thank you. So I'm like, all right, I'll make this my last fight. And that was my thought process. Like, doing wrestling class, I was like, dude, that's for young people. Like, wrestling's hard. It's my back. So I'm like, all right, I just want to do jiu-jitsu. Like, I don't even want to punch anybody anymore. Like, I've reached that point where, like, I don't want to punch anyone. I just want to twist your arm and make you tap. So I'm going to hopefully get a great day job, have some ideas, do jiu-jitsu, get married to my fiance. Look at so pretty. Nice.
Congratulations on that. That's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
So is this you're saying this is it? You know, a lot of fighters retire and then maybe they come back or they get that itch, but you think this is it as far as punching people?
Yeah, like I still want to compete jiu-jitsu. You know, there seems to be a lot more opportunities now than there used to be. I'm excited for that. But yeah, no more punching people. That's I'm done.
So no BKFC for Roxanne Modafari.
Oh no.
Well, we would love to see you in some jiu-jitsu tournaments. Absolutely. Is this the final fight on your UFC contract, or do you have any more after that?
It is.
Well, the timing worked out well for that. You know, what do you think of fighting someone like Casey O'Neill? She's 8-0. She's young. She's upcoming. What are your thoughts on her?
I feel like she almost has a similar style to me, where, like, we march forward and just try to slug them and then take them down. Like, I feel like I've seen that from her. So that's cool. Like, you know, I saw tape on her, and I think that I can beat her. You know, she absolutely could possibly beat me. So it's going to be a great fight. I hope to have a nice little brawl with her and have some beautiful violence. I just want a glorious battle.
Any plans on what you're going to wear at the weigh-in?
Yes, I figured it out.
Did you? Excellent.
It's going to be looking epic. Forward. I can't tell you, but...
Yeah, marvelous. We'll be tuning in to see that as well. Finally, you know, where can our listeners find you on social media if they're not following you already?
On Instagram, I'm Roxy Fighter, and then also Twitter is Roxy Fighter, and then on Facebook is Facebook my name.
All right, and we'll make sure everybody tunes in. UFC 271, February 12th, ESPN preliminaries. Thank you so much for being here, Roxanne. We really appreciate it, and good luck to you in February 12th.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for following my career.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
It's always cool hearing what Roxanne has to say. She's an amazing person. I'm really glad she could join us today.
Yeah, I really appreciate her time and great story.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to believe that she's been in the fight game so long. I mean, 19 years, fighting in all those promotions, all these historic moments from both of the tough seasons to being in the UFC when Dana said it would never happen.
Yeah.
You know, going through that shit in Japan where they're...
Two different Ultimate Fighters.
Yeah. And think about grinding it out in Japan. I mean, just that little bit where she talked about, you know, like the fucking... They call it a costume. It's not really fighting. Imagine she's not even Japanese. I mean, luckily for her, she spoke the language. Mm-hmm. But it's just a wild story to go through all that. You know, to win belts in those organizations, to beat Jennifer Howe twice, and then to Tough, to this, to now.
Invicta,
all the success in the UFC, the Macy Barber fight, fighting for the title, you know, all of these things that she's done. And now 271, you're going to be her retirement fight. Just what a story.
Yeah. And we wish her the best of luck, obviously.
Absolutely. So that's the show for today, everybody.
Yep, that wraps it up.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. If you're brand new, thank you so much for joining us for the first time. You can get information about our podcast in one spot. We're in every major podcast distribution channel there is, plus a couple of radio stations and more. Everything is where?
SWATMMA.com, where you can head over there, click the gear button, and support the podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Later.